Okay, here's a bit of paper napkin maths for you. The Tour de France is 21 stages long. Each stage requires between 5,000 and 8,000 calories, so the average rider burns around 136,000 calories per tour. If a gram of carbs is 4 calories of energy, that means Egan Bernal needs to eat 34 kilograms of carbohydrate this July. That's a lot of pasta and rice cakes.
Wow. Okay, that is a lot of maths, and that is also a lot of calories. But luckily, Bernal and his Ineos Grenadiers teammates have got a secret weapon. That's science in sports energy supplements, including SIS Go Isotonic Energy Gels, the world's first energy gels to mimic the gut's fluid composition in order to be absorbed more rapidly into the bloodstream.
Like all SIS products, Go Isotonic Gels are scientifically formulated to help riders maintain their pace for longer. So each energy gel provides 22 grams of carbs to boost energy on the bike and stave off fatigue.
When Grand Tours are raced on the edge and won by seconds, it's crucial to get the right fuel at the right time. So this summer, join Ineos Grenadiers and add some science to your fueling strategy. Go to scienceinsport.com. the world leader in endurance nutrition, and use the code SIS-TDF23 for 20% off any purchase. That's SIS-TDF23 for 20% off any SIS energy products. Welcome back to the Cyclist Magazine podcast. This week, I am joined by two rather special guests. The first one is Mr. Pete Muir. Pete, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, very well, James. Thank you very much. It's my first time on the podcast. I'm honoured to be here.
I know. I'm honoured to have you because for those of you who may not be familiar with Cyclist Magazine, Mr. Muir is the big cheese. He's the editor. He's my boss. Tell us a little bit about Cyclist Magazine, Pete. What does it do? What do we do? Why did you employ me again?
That's a very good question. Cyclist Magazine is far and away the most fantastic cycling magazine on the planet by no less an authority than myself. It's been around for about 10 years now. It's a magazine that focuses very much on the experience of road riding, as well as a bit of the pro element. It's a beautiful thing. We make sure that we use only the finest photographers, and it's something that people would want, I hope, to actually collect and keep.
Which is true, because occasionally we do get people emailing us with pictures of their collections from issue one. So there's some pretty heaving bookshelves out there. But yeah, I'm obviously biased because I write for Cyclist too. It is a great mag. Absolutely pick it up. It's in Smiths. It's available to subscribe at cyclist.co.uk, etc.
Other news agents are available.
Other news agents. Do you ever shop in any other news agents? I don't.
I'm not even sure I've been in a news agent for many years.
I think they've all shut down. It is wonderful to have you here, Pete. And I'd say that you're only slightly upstage because you're probably the second most important man in cycling by our guest today, who is none other than Tour legend Greg LeMond, a friend of the show. I say that because Greg has come on the show before many moons ago, but he's back. He does today talk a little bit about the Tour de France, which has just happened. And on that note, Pete, because there is the whole conjecture about which is the most exciting Tour de France ever, and Greg LeMond and Fignon 1989 gets trotted out as the most exciting ever. But this year, I noticed lots of pundits going, oh, this is a tour for the ages. This is the most exciting modern Tour de France of all time. So as an editor of the best cycling magazine in Britain, was it?
I've heard like Ola Chenui saying, yes, this is the greatest tour I've ever seen. And I couldn't help thinking, is it? It really was a great tour. You had two titans of the sport in Jonas Vingegaard and Tadej Pogacar knocking seven bells out of each other for a couple of weeks and being within seconds of each other right up to that point where the uphill time trial came along, and suddenly everything changed. Followed by, of course, the mountain day where Pogacar kind of seemed to just lose it.
Yeah.
And it ended up with a final in time difference, which is like the biggest time gap since Vincenzo Nibali in 2014, like 7.5 minutes. So what was building up to be a true epic tour, kind of the air went out of it towards the end, I felt.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And frankly, I blame one man, and that's Tadej Pogacar. He should have just taken Vingegaard closer to the wire. But no, obviously I jest. But that pivotal moment did seem to be the time trial. And it is just insane that Vingegaard put 1:38 into a man who himself beat one of the greatest cyclists of the moment anyway, Wout van Aert, by 40, 50 seconds.
Yeah. So it's those numbers were incredible, weren't they?
Yeah, just incredible. And obviously that raises lots of questions in the whole Twitter sphere and stuff. But I did read a really interesting piece about all of these tiny marginal things that Jumbo are doing in a, you know, to make a poor analogy with football, in a sort of Man City way. So they got the money, but they've got incredible science behind the team. So they have aerodynamicists who are genuine, paid up, you know, mechanical engineers that really know their stuff. But they also did things like putting bikes on top of the rack of the car following Vingegaard, because that just creates a little bit of a wake, because it's a larger object if you've got bikes on the rack of your car than if you don't have bikes on the rack, that slightly pushes the rider. And this is a known effect. And it's something that UAE didn't do. They also did things like strip all the paint off his TT bike, apparently. So I'm now going to quote a really good article on the Escape Collective, which is a website. Other websites are available by Ronan McLaughlin, that sort of said the bike was probably the lightest TT bike in the Pro Peloton this season. They did other special things to it, like change around the front end configuration. And also, I don't know what you thought about it, but he didn't change bikes, whereas Pogacar did.
Yeah, that was a major element in the win. But also, I think the whole thing is quite interesting that it somehow links also to our guest today, because his amazing win in 89 was again in a time trial, and again by using those marginal gains, by using the aero bars that wasn't before. Up until that point, Laurent Fignon was pretty much accepted that he was going to win, and it was eventually Le Mans just said, look, it's not over yet. There's still enough to go, and he still managed to pull back that time trial. I mean, that's what made it the most exciting tour of all time, because of that tiny time gap and because it all happened at the very last second. No boring old procession to Paris. This was racing to the last second, last drop that they could have in that race.
And that is the crucial thing. It's that right up to the wire thing that we just love in sport. But without further ado, who better to tell us that story than Mr. Greg LeMond? It's been lovely seeing your house. It's an amazing house. There's so much. Your houses in the States are so much bigger than ours in the UK. It's just incredible.
Well, except when you look at the royal family. I always thought Lady Di was this, country girl. And then I saw the house she lived in, the Spencers, and it's three times bigger than the White House, or maybe 10 times bigger. So it's either really big or really small. No, we bought this house 7 years ago, and it's one part of the house is actually, it is small, but it was built in 1824. And then the family that did the other part kind of mimicked it. So it's small, but we're kind of packed in with stuff. It's very full. I collect American antiques. So there's a lot of 18th century stuff in here.
So how, or where rather, I'm trying to imagine your house and thinking somewhere in your house, there's got to be a massive pile of wood that you're chopping the other day. Because what people may not know is we were going to have this chat a week ago, and then something happened. You got a massive splinter in your eye, and your wife had to take you to hospital.
Well, it's mulch. I was putting mulch down. Right. I was taking mulch and making a compost pile. So we're kind of getting into gardens and some vegetables and all that. And a piece of wood came up and hit my eyelid. I thought it was a splinter, but it created a blister on the eye. Very painful for a couple of days. So
yeah, I was both sorry to hear and also pleased to read recently you've been back in the cycling press, having been seriously in the wars with leukemia and your recovery from that. How are you, and how's the last year or so been? Is it?
It's actually I'm feeling really good. I'm on a new drug called Tasigna, and it's some of the leukemias are, they don't really know genetics. But this type of leukemia is usually benzene or some kind of heavy toxic material. And I got lead in me. So I kind of believe that's probably the reason I've got cancer, is the lead poisoning. But it's crazy because I have not felt good for a couple of years. And I had 2 years before last year, I had a big drop in my red blood cell count, and I couldn't figure out why. I thought I had internal bleeding, but, you know, try to get on my bike and ride, and it was just too exhausting. But I've experienced that through my whole life, so I'm kind of going, oh, I'm just tired, too much stress or whatever. But actually, I kind of laugh about it because I had an event I was supposed to do last July in France and another one in August for I think it was UK group. And I was trying to get on my bike and I just couldn't do it. So my wife, I'm in Germany, and she calls and tells me that your blood test indicates you have potentially have leukemia. They were certain it was leukemia. And like the first thing I said was, oh my God, I don't have to do those bike rides.
Seriously. Greg, you mentioned that you've got lead in you. Can you explain where that lead came from? Is this from the infamous shooting incident?
Yeah. When I got shot, I had quite a few pellets that went through me, but also I've got about 55 pellets in me spread throughout my body. I have 2 in my heart, 3 in my liver. I thought I had 35 pellets because I've only done x-rays on my chest and stomach. And then I had a crash on a mountain bike 4 years ago, and my shoulder was just killing me. And they took an x-ray of my shoulder and I discovered I had about 15 in my right arm. You know, the sad part is the more I exercise, the higher the lead levels are in my body. And it's part of the problem is where you store lead, it is in the bones, and that's where you store calcium. And when you exercise, you pull out calcium for your mitochondria, but I'm pulling out lead at the same time. And I think that might have impacted my cycling career at the end too, because I was diagnosed with like a mitochondrial muscle disease. And the time at the doctor, actually I'm Belgium, a scientist, he thought it was the lead causing free radical damage, and that he didn't believe I had the genetic disease, which if I did, mitochondrial myopathy, I would have been in a wheelchair 10 years later and probably dead by now. So I think the reality is I had that impacting my cycling career too.
That is totally mad. I mean, you sort of wonder, you know, the sort of science that goes into understanding our bodies and also understanding our bodies for sport and the types of resources that professional teams have now. And I guess back then, you know, you're racing in the 80s, so it's, correct me if I'm wrong, so it's 86, you've won the Tour, and 87, you've broken your wrist at Tirreno, and you've gone home to a convalesce, and then you had this hunting accident where you accidentally shot by your brother-in-law, or you were out?
Brother-in-law.
Yeah. Yep. So just thinking, like, what kind of support did you receive? But more to the point, what did your team say? Was it Cyril Grimaud, who was maybe your DS? I can't think who your DS would have been at the time, but what did your boss say when you said that's what happened? I'm in hospital.
The boss or the director switched with Paul Coakley with La Vie Claire.
Oh, yeah.
That year is called Toshiba. And then the boss was Bernard Tapie, who was, I call him a gangster, who on the team. But after about a month, after I got shot, I got a letter from Bernard Tapie in French. And it was, you know, I always say, like really nice. Cher Greg, we've had a formidable relationship. We've enjoyed our, you know, the past, but basically you're fired at the end of it. So, yeah, I was let go a month after I got shot, which was, at the time I wasn't even certain I wanted to race at that point, but I did think it was a low blow because I was under contract with them. In theory, they should have taken care of me till the end of the year, but they didn't. They just cut it out. So, yep, without a job, won the Tour de France and 8 months later, out of job.
And then you missed the next year as well. But so when you moved teams, was there an expectation that you would just get better, or were people unsure as to whether you'd even be able to race again?
Well, I think that was the big question. And to be honest, I mean, I was really injured and I pretended I wasn't injured, which kind of set me up for years of criticism because it's like, you're just not professional. You don't really want to come back. You're not dedicated. You know, you eat ice cream or you have a burger every once in a while. But yeah, after I think it was 6 weeks, 8 weeks later, I got on a bike and I rode maybe a mile or so. But it was May, June, July, first part of July that I did my first attempt at about a 2-hour ride. And I was in the Napa Valley area. And afterwards, we went down to Chinatown and had a meal with our friends from Belgium. And I thought I had food poisoning. And I had this incredible stomach ache. To the point, by the time I got over from San Francisco to Oakland, we went to a hospital, and it was the most severe pain I've ever had. It turned out it was an intestinal block. So we made it to Sacramento, and I basically asked my wife to kill me. I was ready to jump out of the car. Honestly, it was that painful. And we got to the emergency room, and the surgeon's like, oh, yeah. I had a patient last year who had 22 surgeries because of the same intestinal blocks. And I, my dad's in Europe at that point trying to find a team for me, which were very, there was only two teams. It was Carrera at the time and PDM. And just as I'm going under and I'm starting to think, oh my gosh, nobody's going to hire me with if there's a team that knows anything about intestinal blocks and scar tissue. And so I said, can you take my appendix out? And he's like, what? I said, yeah, just take it out. I want to come back here for surgery. So of course, 2 or 3 days later, everybody found out that it was back in the hospital. Somehow it got out. And I said, yeah, I have appendicitis. No, I didn't even say appendicitis because I didn't have appendicitis. I said, they read my appendix is what I said. So that gave me a little breather. And the one team that I went to, I decided to go with PDM, which is a Dutch team, mainly because they spoke English. But one of the requirements is I was to be on a bike racing that year, which was kind of crazy. But I did show up to race 1st of September in Belgium, end of August and September for Criterium. And I made it about a mile in the race, a kilometer, maybe two. I did one or two laps. And then I pretended I had a flat tire. And then and sometimes I think about it. I said, so the next race, I made it 20 kilometers at Grand Prix Flamies. And somehow in a month and a half, I went to the Tour of Ireland. And I still go back. I go, oh my gosh, I got 39th place over a 5-day race. How the hell did I do that? So it was crazy. I mean, in a way, it just set up this kind of overtraining pattern. So the following year, I got into racing. I was on PDM, and you know, I'd go into the race, and I'd be always in the red zone, and then I'd come home, have to fully recover. And it's not the way you need to build back up. You need a progressive training plan. But it was survival. I didn't have much of a choice. But anyways. It worked out.
How did you keep going? Because for anybody to have those levels of setbacks in any career are huge, particularly in cycling, which is incredibly cutthroat. As you said, you know, you just get dumped by your boss. There's no loyalty. You're out in the cold and you've got to go and find a whole new workplace and colleagues. And then when you're there, you've really got to prove yourself to your new employer. So you've got to race and then your health is suffering. And so you have to even go to hospital and pretend it's something else just to get the real thing seen to. How on earth do you keep going? Who was there by your side saying, don't give up, Greg?
My wife. We got an incredible partnership. And it was difficult because I couldn't talk. You know, it's one thing to be able to inform people how injured you were, letting people give some time, come back. I think it would have sped up my recovery greatly. But in a way, the following year with PDM kind of worked out anyways because I started racing in February, March. In March, I crashed in the race Brabant-Sapil. It's a race near Brussels, and I injured a tendon. And 2-3 days later, I mean, I could barely pedal. I tried to do Tour Flanders and got to the Tour of Italy, made it 5 days, which kind of gave me a little bit break from having to race. And although PDM put my leg in a cast, of course, they believed I was doing something that wasn't helping it heal. And it all goes back to, you know, when I got shot, I shouldn't have been hunting. And I used to, you know, when people tell me I can't do something, I prove that I can and it's not going to hurt me. And part of it is I always, when I came to Europe, one of the reasons when we rode bikes in the United States is, you know, get down with the bike racer, ride ice cream. Was kind of like the treat at the end of the day. And so you're sitting here in France where your choice is fruit and cheese, which I love. Every once in a while, I want an ice cream. And they're like, oh, it's bad for your liver. And I'm going, how can ice cream be truly bad for your liver? A small amount. It's made up of cream, sugar. I think that's pretty much it. Cream, sugar, and eggs. And you got cheese and wine. I mean, I think that still has to go through the liver. So I would then eat some ice cream the day before the race and it just drive everybody crazy. And that's the same with, you know, American who likes hamburgers. When I was there, you're still tied to the United States. And of course, every American likes a burger every once in a while. And so the only thing in Europe that was close to it was McDonald's. And so, you know, would I go down to Nice and have a McDonald's once in 6 weeks? Yeah, I did. And it became like, you're just not serious. And I'm smart enough to read and understand that it's still made up of protein, sugars, bread. And when you're racing, your body's a furnace, truly. It can eat whatever it wants when you're racing. It's more important probably after racing when you're in the winter. but you're racing the Tour de France. I could have probably a cheeseburger every single day and not have it impact my performance. No, it wouldn't impact, even today, it will not impact your performance.
Restrap has been making technical bike packing gear in their Leeds workshop for over 13 years. It's durable and functional. Every Restrap product has a whole lifetime warranty. And Restrap gear is made from sustainable materials wherever possible.
I've been using Restrap bags for a while now, and I've actually just finished riding from London to Tunisia, where I used a Restrap frame bag, and honestly, it's brilliant. Absolutely loved it. The top tube bag is cracking too, and I'd argue that the Restrap Quok sandals are probably the most important piece of bikepacking gear you can buy. Serious game changers for my tired little feet.
Every Restrap product is made in-house, which means they have full control over the production, and their staff are really into the riding too. So that really helps Restrap make easy-to-use, reliable products. Use the exclusive code CYCLISTMAG10 for 10% off at restrap.com. That's CYCLISTMAG10 for 10% off at restrap.com. So there's this wonderful thing about cyclists. We can never admit when we don't know something. And it's just like me and ketones. So someone would mention ketones and I'd be all like, yeah, I know what that means. It's basically just an energy supplement. And it is. But as I've dived into a bunch of research from ketones experts, HVMN, turns out there's a lot more to it. So it sort of works like this. Usually we burn carbs when we cycle, then fat is a backup. Carbs is easy, chuck it straight in the furnace. But for fat to become fuel, we need to turn it into glycerol and fatty acids first. I've got low levels of ketones in my bloodstream as I speak. But what HVMN scientists have done is to work out how to literally make ketones and to put them into a sports drink. They call it HVMN Ketone IQ, and you can drink it during a ride or before a ride. And the idea is that instead of burning carbs, then fat, then ketones when you're cycling, with Ketone IQ, your body gets a big helping of energy-rich ketones to use alongside the carbs and fat all at once. So it's kind of three sources of energy, not two. So it's the reason why I've heard about World Tour teams like Jumbo-Visma using ketones. They can help you effectively ride faster for longer. So if you fancy giving them a try and free energy for faster riding, you know, why not? Then visit hvmn.com and use the promo code CYCLIST at the checkout to get 20% off. So that's hvmn.com and the promo code CYCLIST for a 20% discount. And also, if you want to learn more about how ketones work, then HVMN's got a brilliant podcast, which is also really worth a listen. It's called Health Via Modern Nutrition with Dr. Lat Mansour. And you can find it in all the usual places.
Going back to your time at ADR, where this has been 1988, I'm guessing, your results, you're struggling to ride, your results aren't great. Are you just trying to hang on to your job at this point? Or in your brain, are you thinking, no, I'm still competing for the Tour de France here?
In 88, in fact, I could present a Los Angeles Times article after I won in 1989. But just for some people who, you know, think I was just an anti-doping advocate when Armstrong started racing, that's what he wants to claim, you know. Anyways, but I left PDM in 1988 when I was at home recovering from a tendon surgery that July. The owner of the team called up and was super excited. They just won L'Alpe d'Huez first and second. And he just said, Greg, we've got the recipe, the secret, whatever he said. And it was like right after the finish line. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of time to talk. It was just, he basically said, you're going to win more tours than you've ever imagined. I think the next day, 2 days later, they're both positive. And so I'm going, holy crap. And this is how riders could get seduced into it. Because when I went there in 87 to meet with the team, I thought it was legitimate. They said, you know, Greg, you've been seriously injured. And this is why I wanted to go with the team. You need a real carefully planned comeback. And you need the support of the team medically. And I'm thinking medically, you know, supervised training by a coach or a physiologist. And it turned out the following year, riders were given stuff that was just told were supplements and not educated, not told what it was. And the doctor could have convinced me in most medically, I probably should have had help in terms of testosterone, whatever that was going to help me speed up my recovery. I mean, I'm talking from a medical perspective, you could justify some of that, but from a sporting deal, it's illegal. But that year I said to my wife, I mean, after we heard that when they were positive, like, I've got to leave this team or they've got to fire whoever's responsible for it. And I came back that August and just gave them an ultimatum that I'm leaving the team unless you let go of the rider and whoever gave the drugs. And they started spreading rumors that I was, you know, the guy who's not even professional enough to train properly, doesn't listen to instructions. This is what they spread the rumors in the team. And they said, can you believe he wants more money? Now, my contract was $200,000 in 88 and supposed to go to $400,000 the next year in writing. And so they started just make it look like I was unreasonable. And anyways, we ended up parting ways. I just said, I'm leaving. They wanted to change the contract. So I had called up a friend, Johan Lammerts, at the time, who was on ADR. And that was the only team that I could think of that would even consider me. And I said, could you see if I have could I get a spot on the team? And they said, yes. They had actually approached me in 86. So I had signed a contract. I'll tell you what it was, $375,000 with a $500,000 bonus. If I won the tour, half that salary was supposed to come in January of 89. January came, no payment. February, March, April, May, June, July, no payment. I can only look back now. Sometimes I forget about it because I actually had a decent performance that year. I was sixth place in Tirreno Adriatico. All the potential was there, but I was lacking just this one thing to get me over the edge. But in April, not getting paid again, I just cracked. I said, I can't do this. I mean, and I just went back to the U.S., really tried to figure out if I even wanted to race again. And then decided, okay, I got to go back. Started riding again right before the Tour de Trump, which I was not feeling good there because I didn't ride for a couple of weeks. And then I went in the Tour of Italy. And that's the point of my low point that year where I was dropped by 8 minutes on Mount Etna, then 27 minutes in Trecimi-Lavaredo. And I had cracked at that point just that I can't continue to get dropped. I can't continue to be, it's very hard to win the Tour de France and be a pack filler. Anyways, so it was very difficult psychologically more than anything. Just every race I went into, there was always an article of, you know, Greg cooked. He's almost laughable at times. And I had directors of other teams, when I got dropped, they would smile and laugh, literally laugh, like, they loved seeing me suffer, loved seeing me getting dropped. The truth is, there's one thing I say, I never quit almost anything I do. And even how tempting it is, it was. I, based upon what the doctor told me, I didn't have my lung removed. I didn't have my heart removed. I was there. It just was a matter of time. And I knew that I just had to have the patience, although I almost lost that patience multiple times.
I mean, did you believe yourself that you were going to come back and be as good as your former self?
Blindly, I did, if I just had the time. But the results weren't showing it. And then I said, imagine, so it's 87, 88. So it's about a year and a half. So if you look, I started racing in September, almost 2 years, I would get into a race. And 88 was a wash. I didn't have any results that year. It was very painful because I was not riding well. 88 came and I had a couple hints of success, hints of improvement. But as soon as I'd make that improvement, I got knocked down. But if I think about it now, I almost quit before the Giro d'Italia. And I sometimes look at it as, God, was it just anemia? No, this is just a realization during this call that I stopped riding for about 2 weeks after I was supposed to show up to Liège, Bastogne-Liège, and they were supposed to give me a payment. You know, we didn't have a lot of money at that point. It was very stressful. You know, even thinking about the financial burden that I had, a bike company that was going on at that time. My money that should have kept us alive was being used for that. So the combinations of stress was pretty incredible. But at one point, by the time I got to the Giro d'Italia, I just realized they're not paying me at all. It was actually a relief because I always felt when I signed a contract with a team, I felt a moral obligation to truly perform at my best. That was part of the pressure because I knew I was getting paid or was supposed to get paid. I'm not performing. I felt guilty, actually, for not doing my job. And at one point, I just said, screw it. There's no pressure. I don't have to worry about day-to-day results. This is after I had the breakdown in the Giro d'Italia. After the stage of Trentino Lavoretto, I remember riding and watching Stephen Roach just ride away from me. And I got, oh my God, I'll never be that good again. And I lost 27 minutes and I came back and I just said, Kathy, I'm done. I got to quit. I can't do this anymore. And she convinced me to stick with it till the end of the year. Honestly, I think it was just a pressure valve went off. That's when I decided there's no pressure on me from the team. They can't tell me this, can't tell me that, can't, you know, oh, we're disappointed. Well, I'm disappointed you haven't paid me. That's my my attitude. And I blindly, after I got shot, I didn't have any medical care. The irony is I don't even think I had a blood test with PDM that was supposed to provide that. And it turns out when you lose 70% of your blood volume, you know, you use a lot of iron, you consume everything. And people don't believe it. I'd try to take a multivitamin. I'd forget. I'd take it for 6 weeks and that was it. So never did an iron shot, never did any injections. And during that Trevitaly, it was my friend, Otto Jucom, who kept saying, he always called me Chomp, Chomp, you know, you look gray. You look like you're a woman who's menstruating. I hate to say that. You know, he said, I think you need iron. I think you need iron. I'm like, come on. I take a multivitamin. I eat meat. I don't need iron. And we did a blood test that, you know, and I didn't have any iron stores. And so I had two or three injections of iron, which then became, oh, I had to take EPO that year. I'm bringing that up because it's always, this goes back to a debate I've had with Armstrong. He said, those iron shots were EPO. But the combination of that and the pressure valve release, I started feeling good 2-3 days later. And but I do think it was the iron, the being able to get some oxygen to catch the red blood cells made a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. But you're in a team at ADR, which is heavily Belgian. So it's got a young Museo in it. And you've got Eddie Plankart. You've got people, you know, it's a monuments team. You got a couple of American chaps in there with you, which I'm guess is going to help. But how do you convince a team that you've just described as having not a lot of money? You're not in great shape. Well, you're about to come into good form, but they believe you're not in great shape. And you're on the cusp of not even going to the tour. How do you convince the guys you're going with to kind of help you do what you ended up doing? And we'll come on to how amazing 1989 was, but it's a monumental shift. But within that, yeah, you've got to get your team on side. What kind of conversations did you have with the boys?
Well, I was really, when I was not racing well, I was very kind of isolating in a way. I mean, I remember Frank Host, really nice guy, but during the Giro d'Italia, you know, when you don't, not riding well, I mean, so I went out and had a gelato and he looks at me, Craig, how can you eat that? You're a professional. That's why you're not racing well. And I'm looking at him, that's not why I'm racing well. And I'm sorry, but he was really upset because he felt like I wasn't being dedicated. But it was interesting. And I have to say it was one of the best atmospheres I've ever had on the team. Every one of those guys were really nice people. They were, I actually regret, I would love to stay with that team ongoing, but I wasn't the only one who wasn't getting paid. Eddie Plankert, Museo, nobody was getting paid. And the time at Belgium, there was called black and white money, and you get money above table, and then you get the rest Luxembourg bank account. But I didn't do that. As an American, I have to pay taxes everywhere. And so they paid me the minimum at the Belgian Federation, which was $1,000 a month, and that's what everybody else got paid. I don't know if they got some of their payments on the backside, but I know that most of the riders weren't getting paid. Nobody talked about it because they thought they were the only ones. And I have to say, though, that was probably the most successful team. I think we won Paris-Roubaix, maybe Tour of Flanders, the Tour de France on a couple $100,000 budget, maybe $500,000 budget. I think a lot of the riders were able to watch me suffer. And when I had my last time trial on the Tour of Italy, it was a long 55-kilometer time trial. And José de Cauer, which truly was one of the best directors I've ever had. He was a good coach psychologically. He'd never put pressure. He'd actually come in and, hey, one day at a time was really good for me. And he just said, Greg, he could tell I was riding well. And he said, Greg, why don't you really touch yourself, pretend this is you're going for the victory for the Giro and all that. And I, sometimes, you know, once you're in a stage race like the Tour of Italy or Tour de France, you're not racing well, your drive is just to get to the end. It's hard, especially if you're not riding well, to think you're going to try to go for a stage win. And so I psyched myself up, and especially at time trial, it's very difficult because you either got to be going for the GC or your time trial specialist. And I hadn't had any performance for 2 years. And so I went out there, I ended up getting second place. I put about a minute and 20 seconds on Fignon, who was winning the race. And that played a critical role, like of the 89 Tour, because I knew how much I beat him on the same equipment. But that was probably one of the happiest days I'd had in 2 years of racing. And I could see that everybody else on the team too, it's kind of like one of those, you kind of look at these comeback stories where, you know, the team's down and they're all down, and then they see a glimmer of hope. And it was really neat because everybody kind of, wow, that's great. And that's, I think, happened. 2 weeks later, I raced a race in, I think, Vuelta de Aragon in Spain, and I had a really good performance there. And I could just see the motivation for the riders kind of rising. And when I got to the Tour, I had fourth place in the prologue. And then when we did the team time trial, I was really, really strong. I mean, I did probably 40% of the pulling in that. And I think it just got everybody right behind me. Unfortunately, these guys were classic riders, and they, you know, typically didn't really make it through the mountains. But the riders that were there, Johan Museo, Eddie Plankert, and Johan Lambrecht, you know, did everything good they could for me. But they weren't there in the mountains. But I didn't need it. I would have loved to have a team, but at that point, I wasn't trying to dominate the race where I needed to control it. So I was, you know, racing very strategically, because I don't think I was at my best at that Tour. I was at the limits on the climbs. And sometimes that's okay, because then you waste a lot of energy when sometimes you're the favorite, you know, get up there, your team's riding in front, you're still sitting in the wind. So there, strategically, I think I had, it didn't impact me that much.
So it almost sort of played to your strengths, in a sense that in some ways you kind of underestimated yourself and the team underestimated itself. So yeah, as you say, that pressure valve, that release is gone, that stress, so you can race more freely. But I'm assuming that, you know, your peers, those other racers on the road, they've seen and they've heard what's happened to Greg. So they're not expecting what happens next. But when did you think, okay, this is going well? Because you win the time trial stage five, that's the first stage win of the 89 Tour for you. But was it that moment, or did you think maybe a bit before, hang on, this, you know, what was that touch paper moment where you think, I think I've got something here?
Well, I mean, it was just constant buildup, because in the prologue, I've always looked at the prologue as a good test. I've never, didn't really want to win the prologue. I know it sounds crazy. It would be a wasted team effort to try to control it. And so I was happy if I was in the top five, and I was fourth place a few seconds out of first. And a prologue is really the highest aerobic output that you have in cycling. And when you're good in that, typically I know that I'm going to be good later on. That was just like, wow, okay, I'm as good as almost anybody in the peloton. That was my first sign. The team time trial really gave me a lot of boost of confidence, because that's one of my favorite events, and it's one of my strongest events. Even with LaVie-Claire, Renault, I was always kind of the anchor power rider, and that was a boost. But obviously, the first time trial, that when I won that, it was really, I felt really strong, and that was. But I was, it wasn't for the GC. I'm like, okay, I'm making an improvement, and my goal was a top 20 and win a stage, and I'd done that at that point, but I didn't want to say, I'm the type that doesn't want to, I don't call it jinxing, but it's kind of like, I guess you're hedging your bets. You don't want to proclaim you're going to go off and do something and win it, when you're always better off saying, be a conservative than surprise yourself.
Going into that final time trial, everyone remembers, it's the amazing 8 second, still the shortest ever victory at the Tour de France. I remember at the end of that, just the look on your face. Explain what's going on in your head that matches the look on your face when you know you've won the Tour.
Well, I mean, I actually believed that I could do it, because I actually, on Friday, I won the stage in Exley Band, and I had two really bad days, Lop de Wes and then into Villard de Lens, where I lost time to Fignon. And the next day I was back. I mean, I felt my legs were great. And so I won that stage, and there was a L'Equipe, you know, asked 20 experts, and obviously I was one of the people they asked, and I said I could do it. And one other person thought that I might be able to do it. And it wasn't just out of wishes. I calculated how many seconds I took out of Fignon in the Tour of Italy when I wasn't riding as well. And then I didn't know the aerodynamic advantage of the bars and the helmet, but I figured that would be an edge. And so I thought I would win, you know, within 10 seconds, 15 seconds, or be within 1 or 2 seconds. And so I was pretty confident that I could do it. And then I've always looked at Fignon the day before, and we've had the same coach, Cyril Guimard. You know, races never over till the finish line, and people lose a lot of races by being too confident. And when Fignon congratulated me on my second place, I'm like, I literally said, you're done. You're going to lose. I knew he was going to lose because I knew he was going to take off slowly in the time trial. It's a very short time trial, 16 miles or 26 kilometers. And I knew I had to be right on and take that time off him in the first couple of kilometers. And I do believe that was the difference. He actually, in spite of what Kemar claims in the saddle story, he did a very good time trial. He's third place, one of his best time trials in years. So I think that's called revisionism history. They, you know, it's why did I lose it? Oh, it's the saddle sore. Well, you couldn't have had one of your best time trials just because of the saddle sore. Years later, I was with Fignon, and he kept going, well, I lost 12 seconds into Briançon. I dropped, kind of followed an attack. We dropped him on Izouard. And I said, you didn't lose a beat here. I said, you really did lose it because your coach, who's my coach, who were leaders in aerodynamics, we did wind tunnel tests. We had deep dish rims at that time. This is 82. We had aerodynamic handlebars. We got denied some of the, like the Delta bike with the, we had a teardrop off the saddle. You had the triathlon bars. You lost it because your coach decided not to do it, truly. And I think that would have won him the race. The irony, though, is I did a wind tunnel test a year later, and I'm very aerodynamic position. If you look at my position, without the bars or with the bars. And the bars made up about 10 to 12 seconds compared to my normal position. The helmet cost me 10 seconds.
No way.
The helmet,
wow.
The Giro helmet was, yeah. Because I was with Giro, we were doing this wind tunnel in Texas, and they said, okay, here's the position you have to be in. And I put my head, it was pretty aerodynamic, but not more aerodynamic than a bare head. The best, the most aerodynamic is shaved head or a speed, like a ski suit where you have the bare head and a cape going over your neck. I said, well, that's not how I ride. I ride with my head down, looking up. And so I told the wind tunnel, I said, I need this tested. You need to test me exactly the way I ride. And it cost me time. So it's kind of a wash. And I say that only because without the equipment, based upon the amount of time I took off of Fignon in the Giro d'Italia, I would be within 1 or 2 seconds of him. And so it was just really interesting to kind of do the calculations and the guesswork beforehand. And it turned out to be fairly close. But and that day I felt, I mean, I could have gone probably 20 Ks longer on the time trial. I felt so good. I was fortunate to have recovered after the two difficult days in the Alps. But I think you were asking about the look. No matter what, even if you think you could win it or you're hoping to win it, to actually win it with the struggle that we had was just amazing for us. I mean, we both, Kathy and I, just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is, can't believe we did this. And I mean, our first thought is just, like, oh my God, I was going to quit. Can you believe this? I was going to quit. That's what I said. I can't believe it. I can't believe I won. And so it was a great feeling. It was really good.
Was, by any chance, was Bernard Tappy still around at this point? Did you bump into any of these old guys that doubted you and say, hello, I'm the 1989 Tour de France champion now?
He exited the sport. I think he got indicted or for fixing a match with Valenciennes and Marseille. He was a criminal. So he wasn't in the sport. No, it's interesting. I've been always an outsider. I don't know why. As an American, I don't think anybody was thrilled that I won. I don't know why, but I said I've always been a man without a country. And, you know, if you're French, you have the French behind you. If you're Spanish, you have the Spanish people behind you. So, but that's the way I've always done it. I mean, I didn't have really a big support group in terms of even the American team. I mean, I remember winning the World Championships in 89. Otto just said they weren't even happy when I won. So it's kind of like, it's just weird. Maybe they looked like I had it too good and always worked out for me. But I think, you know, the one thing I went to the Team Z with Roger Leger in 1990. And I went with them. It was real fun in a way because I had all these teams that wouldn't talk to me before: Toshiba, 7-Eleven, PDM, not a chance. But I had quite a few teams trying to, you know, get me to sign with them. But Roger Leger was the only director since '86 that even thought I could come back. And he said, "Greg, before I won the first time trial in the Tour de France, he said, Greg, I really think you will come back. I would really like to talk to you about coming with us next year." And so when I won the tour, I got in negotiations with 7-Eleven at the time. But the best one was Toshiba and Roger Leger with Roger Zanier, who was the owner of the team or the sponsor of the team. This is the week before the Worlds. We had negotiated a very good contract. It was almost $2 million a year. And but Toshiba, I played them along until, you know, the day before the Worlds, and I got him up to almost $3 million. And I said, no way am I coming with you. And I said, you know, you dropped me in 87. There's no way in hell I'd race with you again. And so Roger Leger was certain I was going to back out and try to renegotiate the contract. But I really went to somebody that was, I gave up some money, but I wanted to be on a team that actually believed in me. And I don't forget when Toshiba let me go in 87, same team management. So no way would I go back there.
I feel like that's one of the hallmarks of lots of cyclists is long memories, because you've got to kind of draw on, I'd say a lot of the time, adversity to be able to go that extra mile, to know that you can plumb those depths in order to be able to push yourself even harder come that race day. And I was just thinking to what you just said, Pete, about Greg's face in 1989, that incredibly iconic, massive big grin. And that couldn't contrast more with just how sad Laurent Fignon looked on the podium, the absolutely bereft. Did you guys talk about 89 afterwards? Because I know he mentions in his autobiography that's something that, and he unfortunately died very young as well. It sounds like it was bitterness he carried with him for a long time.
Yeah, but he was, I like Fignon. He was a teammate we were a teammate for 3 years, but he was driven a little bit by anger. And then if he did well, he got super cocky. And I just couldn't stand that part of him. I liked him, but I couldn't stand the cockiness that he literally became this, you know, everybody liked to talk about the Petron. And I just kind of couldn't handle that type of. But people it's weird, riders that would win, they would act, and I'm the Petron, but why, you weren't the Petron before you won, so why can't you just be who you are? And with Fignon, I mean, I got along with him, but I found it very odd that afterwards that he would hold that much importance on a race. It's a Tour de France, but, you know, you learn to lose in cycling. You lose a lot of races. And I've lost the Tour de France in 84, 85. Yeah, it's disappointing, but that's one race. And then you try to build up for the next year. But I think for him, I think he had so much resentment to the journalist that, you know, discounted him, told him he was finished because he won in 83 and 84. 85, he was injured. 86, 87, 88. I actually don't even know what happened in those years. I don't think he was riding well. And when he came back, he wanted to just like, you know, screw you, everybody who didn't believe in me. And he wrote so much importance on that comeback. And when he lost, his mistake is he believed he won it. I mean, that's how he was disappointed because he didn't win it. Well, you should never believe you've won it until you've won it. And that's what I don't understand, the disappointment, because it's a race. I could have dropped him in Lop Duez. I could have dropped him the day before if I was riding well. And he would have still lost, he would have lost the race. So I don't understand the trauma that he lived through, but I know he did. Years later, one of journalists, Philippe Brunel, told me, who's really good friends with him, he went for years. He would never went back to the Champs-Élysées, and he would count. He would walk out a pace 8 seconds, 1,001, 1,002, and he'd go, I can't believe I lost by 8 seconds. And I feel sorry for him because I, you know, to live your whole life sitting here and this, oh my God, I could have won. I could have won 1985 by 5 minutes if Paul Coakley didn't lie to me. And I should be bitter about that. But what can I do? I can't change history. All I could do is look forward to change that. And I could, I didn't, I don't understand it. And it's sad actually for Finian because it's, he did win the Tour twice. He did win the Giro d'Italia, I think, two times. He had an incredible career. And it's sad that your whole career would be, your whole after your cycling would be less than happy and enjoyable because you lost a race, a bike race. I know it's the Tour, but, you know, I won it fair and square. There's people, I had the advantage of the triathlon bar. He had it. But bike racing has always been about technology and human and strategy. You got your physical ability is one thing. You have to be smart tactically, which I think I was. And it's blending that with equipment. It's aerodynamics. And that's with when I hear, oh, I had an advantage over Finian. I did. But he had 2.5 minute lead to me in the team time trial. And I, you'll see in the film, DMR denies it. But I watched Art Finian grab onto a motorcycle in Tourmalet and drag himself up the climb. He would have normally, if an official would have been out of the race at that point. And after that stage, and he took the yellow jersey from me, dropped me by 12 seconds. God, he started ripping on me because I didn't lead up the climb. And I'm like, why would I lead up a climb and put you on my wheel? I mean, I'm not an idiot. I mean, that's the ego. I don't understand it. And a cyclist, because he's got to ride like Merckx or Hino did. And I love Hino, but he makes a lot of mistakes too. He lost a lot of races because of his ego, kind of riding in front, wasting a lot of energy. So I didn't need to be considered a patron or I just wanted to win a race. But Finian, that day, he just ripped me. And I just went up to him the next day and said, you want to rip on me? Should I just tell the press that you were hanging onto a motorcycle the day before? Because I will do that, no problem. So I said, shut your mouth. Femme ta gueule. Femme ta gueule. And he never, then he didn't criticize me after that. But he it's interesting. I saw the movie and I didn't know this, but Finian did make a comment that his only goal was to make me lose. When he didn't think he could win, his goal was to make me lose, which is, this is the difference between me and a lot of racers. I never built my career around not like, you know, I think Armstrong was driven by anger. He had to pick an enemy, and Finian did too. And for me, some people go, I don't remember all the racers I raced with. There are a lot of professionals, but the only thing I looked at, who was riding well at that time. And for me, it was how can I get to the start, to the finish, to win. It was always about my challenge. And because racing, you could predict, you could do all the reconnaissance on climbs. You could do everything you want, but the race is always changing. You can't prepare for a race in advance. It happens as it happens. And for me, it's whoever the competition, however the challenges are, that's what I have to do. And but Finian, I think, was driven by not liking me. Even if he might have liked me, you know, even if he had to build me up as the enemy. And whatever motivates him, but I find that I don't comprehend that mentality.
So that film that you mentioned is, that would be Last Rider.
I'm sorry, yes, Last Rider, yes.
Yeah, so the documentary that's just about to come out in the UK, I think, or possibly already on.
I think
General
today in the UK and in the US, I think it's today. We had a local premiere in Knoxville, and I've seen it once, but the second time I just picked up a few things that it was really interesting to watch Pedro Galdado, which I didn't know his story during that tour. That's the thing, you only do your own race.
Because it seems like at the moment, cycling is experiencing a kind of a cinematic boom. because you've got Last Rider coming out. I'm not sure if it's how big it is in the States, but the Netflix documentary Tour de France Unchained. And this is a chat that Pete and I had the other day about the things that draw people who aren't necessarily big cycling fans into the world of cycling. And if you look at the beginning of Unchained, it's just crash montages, boom, 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 boom. And it's this high octane stuff, but it's centered around crashing. As a racer yourself, what do you think when you sit down and watch something like that, which I guess is probably in Last Rider as well? Do you sort of feel like, hang on a second, this is a bit gruesome? It's a bit kind of ghoulish?
Well, I'd say today's racing is more gruesome than when I was racing. Honestly, I think I feel bad for the riders today. And I don't know where the disconnect is within pro cycling, but it's proven with driving, you cannot be on radios and you can't be racing a bike at the same time. And it's not just the radios by distraction. And I've talked to riders. The problem is you got the directors yelling at them that they have to be in the front. When I was racing, there's a little delay in that. You had to read it and you'd feel it. You'd know there's potentially a road coming up that you have to turn right on at 5 kilometers, 2 kilometers, but you didn't have the details. And I think having that much detail and knowledge and then the director telling you that you have to be there, you're forcing everybody, 200 riders, into a very narrow path. And when I think of the amount of time some of these riders are crashing, it's, I can't believe it. And if that was a deal that you wanted to take some of that risk away, I think, I'm not saying take away the radios between, I always felt like radios from rider to the team for help, mechanicals is the way it should be. But I would love to see a couple races done without radios so that you could actually see the strategy between the riders. That was the beauty of cycling. It wasn't, you know, the sad part, if you have a really poor director who has no clue of tactics, he's going to be driving the race. That's kind of, I couldn't do it. But I think what you said about the footage today, it's amazing. You got live coverage and Netflix, what it did for Formula One in the United States, and now there's Swing with Netflix about golf. I really think Netflix, if they could do a job like they did with Formula One, cycling is going to have a big increase in viewership because there's nothing like cycling. I mean, if you go through the Tour de France, there's more drama and inside stories that happen within that race than two seasons of Formula One. I mean, it's human drama, it's crashes, it's everything. I think people like, and I think at least in the U.S., I do believe before even how tacky they were when they did the Tour de France in the 80s, they would build up these human stories with it. It wasn't just the race, and you had to do that for the basic public. But in the last 20 years, it's been either results or live footage or results in cycling news or any kind of publication. It seemed like interviews of athletes had gone away and people want to connect with people. And I think when people can see the athletes, the cyclists as humans, find out, you know, what motivates them, what their family support system, the struggles they go through, that's what creates a fan base. And I think for cycling, this Netflix is really good. I wish they would have done it in English. I said, it's so French. Oh, come on. Everybody speaks English now. The audience is broader than France, but maybe it sounds romantic. I don't know. But I think it's a great thing for cycling, truly. And I have to say, I think cycling is going to enter in a really great period because you've got a new generation of riders. I'm a skeptic about the past, the motors, the doping. And I see riders today that are so good at 19, 20, 21. You have all these guys. I mean, you have a class of riders that dominated the last decade gone like that instantly. And I go, how is that possible? It doesn't happen that way. I have my own theories, but I do think we've got all these young riders. I always think cycling is exciting when you have, I think my 86 Tour de France was exciting. 89 is because you had two riders that could win the Tour de France battling it out. Truly, that's what creates excitement. And I think this year's could be one of the best tours ever. I mean, I look at it. I mean, even last year's tour, you go, Pogacar, I thought for sure had it. And then Vindigo winning it is who expected that? And this year's, you've got 3 or 4 players that are going to compete for it. So it's going to be a really good period.
Yeah, I mean, Greg, when this podcast comes out, the tour may be done and dusted. So who is going to have won in your mind? And of course, people will know the answer by the point.
Pogacar will win because he is truly, I think, when I watch him racing Tour of Flanders, I think he's could be one of the greatest cyclists ever. I mean, honestly, it's such a raw natural talent, but God, he's complete. And, you know, and a good Tour de France is very difficult. I mean, and the great thing is everybody is so close, but he's got the true depth of talent, but his mental, he seems very calm, and he seems, you know, that he can perform in all types of conditions. And he's just getting to go. I still put him as the favorite by far, but who knows? Evan Poole, I think he's doing the tour. Remco, right?
No, I don't think so. No.
And I think Roglic is not doing it.
No. So it's going to be Pogacar and Bendigo. Yeah.
God, that's crazy. I was hoping Evan Poole was going to do it. I mean, I thought for certain he was going to do it after he had to quit the Giro. That's who I thought was going to be in it. Okay, so it's going to be Bernal. I don't know if he's going to be at his best. You never know. He could. Dauphiné is too soon to say you're going to be there or not. But shoot. Gosh darn it. I'm bummed out.
And you said, you know, there's some really big talent in the tour at the moment. But what we're not seeing a lot of is American riders. I mean, where's the American cycling scene at the moment? Because officially, you're still the only American Tour de France winner.
Yeah, I'm really Sepp Kuss, Nelson Paulus. There's a lot of good riders. I'm always shocked that I actually keep thinking, who's going to come out next? And you got Magnus Sheffield's really good talent. There's a couple of young riders here in the U.S. that are really, really talented that I think are going to have potential for big results in the Tour de France. So, but, you know, the Tour de France it takes just one great rider. Think of Belgium. When's the last time they won the Tour de France? Eddy Merckx. And so in France, it takes just one great rider from a country to dominate. And it's a sport where the Tour de France truly is like the best top. It's a race that the talent truly rises to the top. And that's why you can get periods of dominance for 3 or 4 years. Because once you're there, I always say like a classic, you got 15 people go win, you know, a typical race, whatever, maybe more than that. But a 1 week stage race, you got 10 people. You get to the Tour, you got 3 people usually. And usually after a couple of years, you start getting the kind of the hierarchy. One rider continues to kind of dominate. That's why it's really interesting today, is because there's some talent that's so close that it could be the one period where if Bendigo wasn't there, Pogacar would have probably a 5-year. That's how easy. Sometimes it sounds crazy, but I really believe that if I look at my tour races, 85, I could have won. 86, I missed 2 years out of a hunting accident, and I won 89-90. There was nobody in 87-80 that would have come close to me. So I could have had a stretch there, 5 or 6 tours. And I think that, unfortunately, for like a guy named Pogacar, he might not have that chance because it might be trading between Bendigo, Pogacar, Bernal. Who knows? Evan Poole could be a guy that could win the tour too. You know, we'll see. He hasn't tested himself at that level. But, I think it's going to be good racing for the public.
And so will you be tuning in, Greg, because I know that it's probably quite a weird thing for you to have been so involved in something and then also to sometimes probably just want to kind of put that to one side. You know, we don't want to think about our work when we're not necessarily doing it. And then having people like me come along and go, hey, Greg, what do you think about cycling now, as if you should somehow still be an expert? But do you sit down with Kathy and you're watching those stage highlights every day and you get really into the tour every year?
Kathy watches everything. So I watch. I'll follow it, but I watch the big stages. I mean, because I'm always doing something in the day. I'm not somebody who can sit down for 3-4 hours. I don't have that time, actually. But I do watch the big stage, and I do follow it. I'm more excited about it today than probably ever, just because I see I look at the RPMs that riders were riding the last decade, and it's just not natural. And I'm looking at the RPMs today, and they're back to historical 80, 90 RPMs on the climbs. And yes, people say, well, the climbing climbs faster today. Well, they should be, because it'd be like me racing at 68 kilos and I'm now 63 kilos. And so I've read some stuff, and I have a big concern about doping and cheating and cycling. I do believe motors were real. I mean, I know they were. And I think they won a lot of races, big races. and telltale signs, high RPMs. For some reason, you're not seeing that. And why is that? Because David Lapartien, I think the UCI has really cracked down on it. You don't see that. And you go back to every output of power output. Every rider's with, there's an efficiency range of RPMs to power output. And there's no hyper training of RPM. You can't train it. You climb at 100 RPMs when really everybody else is most efficient at 90. Otherwise, you'd be having to produce 50 to 75 watts more. And I look at that today and I'm going, okay, this looks really good. Of course, they're racing fast, but as they should be. And I think the riders today, with the pressure to eat less, lose muscle mass, it's going to result in faster climbing. No doubt. It has to. I mean, I know if I lost 3 kilos, 4 kilos, I would be climbing significantly faster.
So when you watch the tour today, are you happy that what you're seeing is clean racing?
Yes. Clean is always something. It's really hard to get a culture completely out of cycling. I guess I'm really happy to think that there's limits to it. And what you want is riders to be healthy, not dying. And you want to make sure that riders who aren't doing things can still compete. And I guess I'm maybe giving Thibaut Pinot too much of the benefit of doubt, but I do believe the French cyclists have a higher scrutiny of risk associated with doping programs. And when Thibaut Pinot publishes all his data from the day he started racing all the way as a pro, and he almost won the tour in, was it 2019, 2020? That's a really good sign, truly. It is a really good sign because you could tell the French didn't have much of a chance since Astana. Astana, that's a long time to go with no performance. There's no way that there wasn't talent in France. There was talent, but they were eclipsed because it wasn't clean. It wasn't legit. But today, I think it's really, I mean, whenever riders, when I was 18, I bet if I got into the tour at 18, because I know how I compete in 18, 19, I could have been in the top three at that age. And that's, you don't change your genetics. Your talent is there. Typically, that when I was racing, the idea is wait till you're 24, 25, because the belief it was such a heavy workload. I think that's not relevant today because we know more about, you can, at 21, 22, you can recover from that. There's no magical 25 years old that you have to start racing the tour, but that was the case when I was racing. Wait until you're 24, 25. So, no, it's great. I think it's really exciting right now.
Do you ever look at things like Pinot's numbers and compare your own and think privately to yourself, yeah, I could probably still win this if I was back into my 20s?
I think I could, of course. I mean, every rider, but because I have the genetics there. I think I have a motor, let's say, a human motor, as good as anybody in the peloton. And I think, you know, I do think that it's interesting for riders. I smile at this because I probably felt this way when I turned pro. Oh, cycling's much harder than it was when Eddie Merckx was racing. Well, Eddie Merckx quit 3 or 4 years before I started racing. How could it have gotten that much harder? And a pro races for 14 years, typically, 14 years. And in my 14 years of racing, it was just as hard my first year in 81 as it was, let's say, until EPO came in 1990. I didn't notice this big improvement because it doesn't change that much. And so it's a very slow progression, and athletes adapt to whatever's given to them. And so if I was racing today, yeah, I'd probably have to starve myself like everybody else. I would adapt to what that is. And I think that's why it's hard to compare eras. I do think the riders are under more pressure today than I was. I think the scrutiny of the press, but also I said the radios, the hyper-focus on science with the belief that your diet really makes a difference is putting undue stress on cyclists today, because I don't believe there's been any miracles in diet from the 80s to 90s. It hasn't. There hasn't been. I can tell you, I do study this a lot, and it's all following trends. It's no different than in 1990 when everybody started, you know, 91, everybody said it was because they ate low fat and lost weight while they're performing. Well, no, it was EPO. Nutrition hasn't changed that much. You get more knowledgeable about, I don't know. I did a lot of studies. I know even from back then, it's, you know, your carbohydrate consumption, your molecule intake, how it empties your stomach. I would do the same thing today. So usually there's not really any secrets except for proper training, proper rest, you know, it hasn't, physiology doesn't change, but humans still the same. But I do think there's, what is different today compared to what I was racing is the knowledge base for proper training. I think the riders today on the peloton have much better access to the physiology, the science of overload recovery. I was fortunate because the team I was went with, Guimard, it was all, he had a background in training, went to Switzerland with sports science school. Paul Coakley was a sports scientist. He, you know, I wrote a book in 1985 called The Complete Book of Cycling. And in 2014, Laurent Tendance saw me and said, Greg, you know, he showed me the book. He said, I bought this. I found it at a bookstore 6 years ago. It's the best book I've ever read for training. And that was written in 85, but it was done based upon physiology 101 and overload, rest, recover. The thing with drugs is that you can bypass the natural cycle of, you know, when you take testosterone, you can overload yourself more. But, you know, proper training, proper intensity, proper volume and recovery, it's still there. It hasn't changed a whole lot. I think the knowledge, the power meter for me, the most important thing that I've seen with it is, am I recovered? If I could know that I'm recovered, that's the key thing, because more people hurt their performance by training when they're not recovered. You make your big improvement when you're fully recovered before you do your big workload.
What I find interesting is it's that level of detail, which I find absolutely amazing that you can still be abreast of when, you know, you retired in the mid-90s. So this is 30 plus years on. And it's amazing to me that you're not a DS. But just before you go, do tell us what you are doing with your professional life in cycling at the moment. I'm sure those DS contracts are knocking on the door, but where are you and what are you up to at the moment in your professional life?
I started two companies in 2006. My bike company restarted 2014.
So this is Le Mans Cycles.
Le Mans Bikes, yeah. And I put that on a shelf because in 2015, I was visiting Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Knoxville, actually in Oak Ridge. It's where they invented the Manhattan Project, enriched uranium. And it's a material science laboratory, and they had invented a process to lower the cost of carbon fiber by 50%, which is a massive decrease in cost. As I learned and met the team, that the carbon fiber is geared towards high volume applications like automotive, wind, energy. And I asked the founder, what are they going to do? And they said, well, we could license it. We formed a company called Le Mans Carbon in 2016, and we licensed that from Oak Ridge, and then we secured another license from Deakin University, which is probably even a better breakthrough. It speeds up the oxidation and lowers the cost, even with high-cost materials, by 30%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's massive. And with another thing that we're working on, it'll lower our cost by 50% on aerospace-grade fibers. So But now this is it's a startup, and it's been 6 years in the taking and in the process, and COVID really killed us for funding. So we're still in the final stage, I hope, of getting this capitalized, but it's a big investment, but it's a massive opportunity. And it's really been really exciting for me because getting in the composite world, carbon fiber, I've seen ways of making stuff and composites that could be innovative for cycling, which we want to bring into to the bikes. It's really exciting, but at the same time, I could be out of business and out of a job in 6 months if things don't work out. I always say, if you want to see my life for the last 6 years, watch the comedy series called Silicon Valley.
Oh, yeah.
We've lived every high and low that startup has experienced. It's why I got gray hair now. Oh, no, I had it before. But it's been exciting, but it's very, very trying to high levels of stress. It's either you're going to make it, you're going to die. And it's been, would I do it again? I don't know. It's like.
So Greg, are you using these composites in your bikes that you are currently selling, especially the e-bikes?
No, because we're producing small volume of carbon fiber in Australia, not in full scale production, but we will. To build a factory together is about $50 million. And so the whole investment's almost $100 million. And it's harder to get the funding. I know it sounds like a lot, but I've seen bike companies like Lime, Bird raise $1.5 billion, and they're out of business. Or this is a company that we've got already pre-sales of a lot of value in it. So this is to me a no-brainer investment, but very few people know about, understand carbon fiber. They look at, it's a risk that they don't understand it. It's a very small knowledge base within the carbon fiber industry, because usually these investment groups, venture funds or whatever, private equity, they depend on consultants, and the consultants aren't really informed. They look at the past history, not the future. So it's been a trying period, but we're very close. So either I'll open a bottle of champagne, or I'll be drinking water from a puddle with a napkin, trying to get the filtered water.
Well, Greg, that sounds, I'm convinced that sounds incredibly exciting. Sign me up. But for now, thank you so much for spending all this time with us this evening. Well, lunchtime for you this evening for us, but it's been absolutely magic to talk to you. It really has. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. No, I apologize for the back and forth. We could have done it some other days, but my wife's been handling this, and I had to do all these interviews for this movie. So it was... I didn't even know how to do them.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much to our guest, Greg LeMond. What an absolute legend. A man who is simultaneously the hardest person to interview because he's impossible to keep on topic, but also the easiest to interview because all you have to do is say, "Hi, Greg," and off he'll go. He'll be entertaining. He'll be insightful, controversial. Yeah, the perfect guy you want on your podcast. And also one of the busiest guys you want. Important to mention that he has coming out his movie documentary, The Last Rider. It's out on the 2nd of September. It's going to be in cinemas. Go and see it. It's all about that race, that 1989 Tour de France. And he's also got his bike business going. The man's incredibly busy. He's bringing out a range of e-bikes. Possibly a road bike, who knows? But yeah, take a look at that. Go and have a look at LeMond bikes.
Absolutely. And I really hope that road bike does come out, because that, again, is one of, I'm not sure, I think we probably talked to Greg about this in episode, little plug actually for the previous episode that Greg was on, episodes 21 and 22. We split them into two parts. It was that long back in those days. And we did talk about his equipment that he was riding back in the 80s. And I love the fact that he was the first guy to ride an all carbon fiber bicycle through a Tour de France, and I think win on it. Before there were carbon fiber bicycles, but they were bonded aluminium, blah, 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 blah. I won't bore you with the minutiae. But seeing a blueprint for the new road bike, as in the one that will hopefully come out next year, it just looks really on point. It's got that very old school kind of round tubed look, which I just love those original Le Mans bikes. So hopefully he's going to carry that through, because that'd be nice to test.
Well, let's watch this space. And when it comes out, hey, we'll get him back on again.
Pete, it's been an absolute pleasure. Until next time.
James, take care.
Okay, here's a bit of paper napkin maths for you. The Tour de France is 21 stages long. Each stage requires between 5,000 and 8,000 calories, so the average rider burns around 136,000 calories per tour. If a gram of carbs is 4 calories of energy, that means Egan Bernal needs to eat 34 kilograms of carbohydrate this July. That's a lot of pasta and rice cakes.
Wow. Okay, that is a lot of maths, and that is also a lot of calories. But luckily, Bernal and his Ineos Grenadiers teammates have got a secret weapon. That's science in sports energy supplements, including SIS Go Isotonic Energy Gels, the world's first energy gels to mimic the gut's fluid composition in order to be absorbed more rapidly into the bloodstream.
Like all SIS products, Go Isotonic Gels are scientifically formulated to help riders maintain their pace for longer. So each energy gel provides 22 grams of carbs to boost energy on the bike and stave off fatigue.
When Grand Tours are raced on the edge and won by seconds, it's crucial to get the right fuel at the right time. So this summer, join Ineos Grenadiers and add some science to your fueling strategy. Go to scienceinsport.com. the world leader in endurance nutrition, and use the code SIS-TDF23 for 20% off any purchase. That's SIS-TDF23 for 20% off any SIS energy products.
And don't forget that the Cyclist Magazine podcast comes from Cyclist, which is also a magazine which you can subscribe to and get every single month. And we're also a website, cyclist.co.uk. And we've also got some brilliant social channels for up-to-date pro and tech and everything else coverage. So that's Instagram and Twitter.